Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay, yeah. So it's the 27th of March, 2018, and I'm here in Rome with Professor Renato Mauro, Professor of Political Science at Roma Tre, who has worked extensively in the field of religion and politics, an area in which George Mosley was also deeply interested. Professor Mauro, thank you so much for taking the time to
thank with you
me today.
It's an honor and a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. So what is your current title
I am full professor of contemporary history. In Italy, it means late modern history.
Okay.
Political sciences,
okay.
Department that means political studies, political affairs. I teach both undergraduate and graduate courses. Basic general course on contemporary history and a graduate course the title is International History of Peace. That is a sort of introduction for the graduate students to the peace issue. That is history of peace ideas, peace movements, peace organizations in the last centuries. And then a course about fascism.
And where were you born? And when and where were you born?
I was born in 1951 in Rome.
Okay.
My family was partially a Roman family because my mother was born in Rome too. His father and mother were born in Rome too. That is, from the side of my mother, my family was an old Roman Catholic family who stayed in Rome since the 19th century, a middle-class family, attorneys at law, a notary.
Mm-hmm. Notary public, yes.
Yes. From my father's side, on the contrary, the family came to Rome from Apulia, that is the Italian south. It was very different. But I am really a real Roman. It's not
very Roman.
Yes, it is. It's not very common because, of course, Rome is a capital city full of people coming from outside.
So what was your childhood like?
Yes. Well, my family was really an engaged Catholic family. Not only my uncle was one of the leaders of Christian democracy.
That's Aldo.
Yes, that's Aldo.
Right.
Prime minister, foreign minister. He came out from Catholic Action in his juvenile years. He was president of the Catholic Federation of University Students, FUCI, FUCI, Federazione Universitaria Cattolica Italiana, and then secretary general, that means president, of the Catholic Organization for Catholic Graduates and Professionals. And my father, too, had been president of the FUCI and vice president of the Catholic Graduate Association. So, really, a family very involved into the Catholic movement and Catholic action in Italy. A sort of engaged but I think also open Catholicism, because the FUCI, that is the University Federation, and then the low rates, graduates movement were inside Catholic Action the more progressive ones.
Mm.
They were linked to the personality of Giovanni Battista Montini, that is the future Paul VI Pope. This was a group who was trying to open Catholicism to modernity. They did not want to react against modernity and propose a sort of Catholic alternative. They were working for a sort of fusion, that is, Catholicism had to recognize and absorb all the new needs of the modern man without contrast, but with sort of dialogue. So this was Catholicism, not fundamentalist, not anti-modern, not close to secular thinking. I remember very well the enthusiasm of my parents when the Second Vatican Council was open, and the enthusiasm for the new Pope, John the 23rd, his new habits with the world. I remember when I was very young, it was 1961, I think, and I was brought to the opening. It was the opening day of the council, and the Pope gathered people in Piazza San Pietro, and I was there with my father. We listened to this famous speech by the Pope about the moon. He invited fathers to bring the Pope's salute, the Pope's hail to their children. Very human perspective. I remember so well the hopes and expectations of a change in Catholic Church there.
That's fascinating. It was part of that religious revival after the war.
Absolutely, they were absolutely the fruit of the religious revival. About which George Moss has written in his books. My family had also, I would say, high intellectual standard. That is, the friends of my father and mother were relevant personalities and figures in Italian Catholicism. I remember one president of the Constitutional Court, Leopoldo Elia, a woman, Paola Gagliotti, who became one of the representatives to the European Parliament in recent years, some journalists, one, Piero Pratesi, was the editor of the Christian Democratic newspaper, Il Popolo, the other one was the editor of the Italian bishops newspaper, L'Avvenire. There was a very good and relevant historian as Pietro Scoppola. Pietro Scoppola was an historian, but was also the founder of an intellectual movement that attempt to a renovation of Christian democracy, the Lega Democratica Nazionale, the non-nazionale, the Lega Democratica, the Democratic League, in the 1970s. So it was a very stimulating environment.
And optimistic.
Very optimistic. Mm-hmm.
I remember some of that myself, because I remember when our bishop went off to the council in 62.
Yes.
And the excitement. It was a time, the beginning of the 60s, it was a time of
of
optimism, potential for change.
Great optimism.
And you did have that religious revival in the Midwest too, with people like Gene McCarthy and politics and religion and the kind of progressive Catholic Catholicism.
Yes, so this was exactly my formation.
Very interesting. So your family was political, and it always
very political in the sense that they discussed about politics very much. It was not political in the sense that they did not participate to any active political movement because of the existence of my uncle. My father was a judge, and as a judge it was impossible for Italian judges to belong to every political party, to be politically active. Second, there was the problem of possible involvement of my uncle in any political militancy. So while the family discussed so much about politics, nobody was really engaged in it. So I developed, I think, a sort of attitude of the committed observer more than of a militant. I have never participated to every political movement.
So you kept your distance and analyzed. And understood.
Yes. I had my sympathies, of course. In a certain period, I was a progressive Catholic, so people knew me. And for example, at the beginning of the 1970s, I don't remember it, I think it was for the municipal elections of 1976, somebody from the Communist Party asked me if I was willing to enlist, not in the communist electoral lists, but in the list open to independent people. I refused, of course, because I didn't want to have a political career of any kind.
Well, it's a rich and fascinating political period in Italy after the war and the Civil War and the history in politics of Christian democracy. Of course, we can't go into all of that. So where did you go to school? You went to Catholic schools?
No, never. This was another. Well, never is too much. 2 years of elementary school at the beginning, but only because we were in a new Roman district with very few public schools. It was not easy to find a public school there. But my family was Catholic. They were engaged Catholics, but they were also very loyal to the public service, the conception of the public service of the state. My grandfather, with my same name, Renato Moro, he was a teacher of elementary school, then he was an inspector, a supervisor of schools, and then he became relevant official of the Ministry of Education as responsible of rural schools. He was one of the founder of the rural school in Italy. So my family had a sort of cult of public school, that is, Catholic private school, well, it may be good because they will teach you Catholic doctrine, Catholic values, but we will do this in family. While you need to meet every Italian of every condition, of every economic level, of every culture, you need to mingle yourself with society, so you have to go to the public school. So I have always attended public schools.
So this kind of civic culture, civic engagement, is not in many ways a long-term part of the Italian social culture, if I understand it correctly. Is it something that comes after the war and there's a kind of engagement with that?
No, I think it is an old story beginning with the liberal state.
Okay.
With a strong idea of be civil servants as a status, dignity, independence, and I think also laity, that is secularism. My family was really Catholic, but they were secular Catholics, that is, not confessional ones. Well, of course, they revered the church, but they were also independent. I remember so well, they taught me, you have to think by yourself. I remember when I went to the preparation to the First Communion, the nuns, well, they prepare, I was 6 years old. They told this terrible story about a young boy who did not make, well, he took an apple from a garden. He did not confess, and he had his first communion. And the story was terrible because the story was that Satana came to take him, his soul away the day of his first communion. I didn't tell anything. I came back home and I did not succeed in sleeping the night. I awake with nightmares. My parents asked me, I explained the thing the day after. My father took me in my hands, he brought me to the parish priests, and he protested. He took me away from the nuns and passed to another.
Good for him.
Yes, this is the first time I learned that to be a Catholic did not mean to obey to priests. You have to think yourself, it was possible to have a different Catholic culture, even contrary to what the church was practicing. So this was the kind of Catholicism I learned from my family.
Different from me, I must say. So where did you then go to university? How
yes.
did you get interested
yes.
in, I well, understand your family background
yes.
and culture would have made you interested
yes.
in your subject, but.
History was my last choice. I came to history in the last year of high school. Before, well, I was really interested in humanities. My family had a very strong humanities background. My mother was professor of Latin and Italian in the secondary school. My aunt, the sister of my father, was professor of Greek in high schools. So very strong humanities background. So my first, I have to add something. My mother's sister worked at the university with a professor of history of music, played the piano. He then became an official in the Italian television, the educational programs. So I developed a very strong love for music, for classical music. Well, this may be interesting. She was a widow, then she married with an American Jewish mathematician who came to Italy to in order to study the Italian educational TV programs. They fell in love. They traveled to the US. This may be interesting because his husband, Howard Levi, was a Jew. He came every summer to Italy. He participated to the Manhattan Project as a very young man. And he, well, I remember clearly, well, he visited Europe every summer together with my aunt. They visited France, Italy. They never went to Germany. He repeated that he couldn't listen to German anymore. Even if it was an American Jew, only some relatives were involved into the Shoah, but he was still injured by the German language. Well,
that's so different than Mosse.
Yes.
Went back so quickly
this is,
after the war, and I guess he, in a way you'd have to say he didn't take it personally. You know, he didn't think it was about him directly, although he probably had more reason to think so, since
yes.
Hitler had attacked
yes,
his
of
family
course.
So directly. But yeah, I think he was unique in many ways in the sense of
yes.
how he approached all of that.
I imagine that the normal reaction might be that of my...
Yes. And there may have been a time that was his reaction to it. I don't know, but he, yes.
Yes. So the first idea I had was, well, to become a scholar. This was clearly my option. I remember my mother asked me, what do you want to do? I don't know, was my answer. The only thing I know is that I want to study. Continue studying. My first option was humanities literature. In the first years of the high school, I would have liked to become a literature critic or something like this. Second option was music. My love for classical music was so high, I was dreaming of becoming an historian of music. Then, the last year of high school, I began to listen to my grandmother tales about his youth. He told that, well, he married in 1919, and his wedding journey was in Vienna during the Red Revolution. So their tales about this city after the war, ruined and now poor with the red flags, the revolution, they fascinated me. Then he continued with something about the Italian intervention into the First World War at Radiant May 1919. She told that they lived in Piazza Esquilino in Rome, that was very near Giolitti's apartment. And she remembered the day in which there was the intervention, the crisis, the parliamentary crisis around interventionism, and all the Giolittian deputies went to Giolitti's apartment and left their card as a form of solidarity to Giolitti against the aggressions that were in the streets against these, well, the aggressions, the mob that cried that Giolitti was a criminal, bad affair minister. And also these tales fascinated me. Then I had in my third last year of high school a very good professor of history. So I changed my mind and I decided to try history at the university. But my family intervened. My fa not heavily, not heavily, but they tried to convince me that history, well, it was a very good idea, but an historian will not have social condition well off enough.
This, even then, people were concerned about this, yes.
So my father, especially my father, suggested look to Pietro Scoppola, who is now an historian. He has not come out from history courses. He attended law school. He's become member of the studies office of the Italian Senate. It's better that you go to a law school. There is history of Roman law, there is history of the Middle Ages law and early modern law. You may find satisfaction in your aspiration even in a law school. So I enrolled to Jurisprudenza. And I began to attend my first courses, and my first reaction was not negative because the first course I met was philosophy of law, so it was a very humanistic perspective. Then the second one was history of Roman law. It was a history course, sort of history of the Roman Constitution, very fascinating. The third one was political economy, so it was easy. Then the first law course came, private law, and I went to my father and asked him, Daddy, what is law? The first courses of this one. And he said, unfortunately, I have to admit that it's the second. And, well, I want to change. And I passed to
Oh,
humanities.
good.
And it's interesting because I passed the humanities, I began to attend the modern history course of Rosario Romeo, one of the greatest Italian scholars.
At La Sapienza, or?
Alla Sapienza. Alla Sapienza, you the faculty in the School of Humanities.
Which was excellent.
He was excellent. He was excellent as an historian, one of the greatest Italian historians of the second half of the 20th century, but also a great teacher. His lessons were probably the more beautiful lessons, university lesson I have ever heard. And his first course was about Europe in the 16th century, and there was a book he indicated as required reading. It was George Mosen, Königsberger, Europe of the 16th century. So I was immediately, I met not George Mosen as a person, by one of his books. And I was not only fascinated, but already the Romeo's lectures, but also the book confirmed me that my choice was good. I felt to be at home for the first time.
So it sparked an interest. This is a
Yes,
confirmed interest.
confirm my history because do you remember that book is, well, for me it was completely new because popular culture, masses' perception, not only high intellectuals, but mentality, popular religion. And there was a second aspect, I immediately realized that fundamental. This it was a not dualistic, dichotomical approach to the 16th century. Moses showed how much it was modern, new, and at the same time how much irrational, traditional, not humanistic there was in that culture. So I was fascinated by an historian who was able to think in ambivalent terms and show how much ambivalence was important for history.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was written in a unique way because they wrote alternate chapters.
Yes, but
you could tell the Mossian.
Yes,
right? Yes.
Königsberger was more about economics, if I remember
right.
Well.
Yes.
Economics.
Business.
Economics. It was so important for the 16th century. The discovery of the Americas, the problem of gold from America, the market, the prices, the fugue. It was so important, but what fascinated me was the part about popular culture, religion, witchcraft. I remember so well.
I was fascinated by the chapter on Baroque Rome.
Yes,
two.
Absolutely.
So then you decided to study with De Felice?
Yes.
Okay, how did that come about?
I began to attend to the history courses. One I attended immediately after Romeo was exactly De Felice. De Felice was making a very interesting course. It was about the relations between Italian fascism and German Nazism before the Nazi seizure of power. This in the 1920s up to 1932. De Felice, contrary to Romeo, De Felice was not a good speaker. He had problems in speaking, but his lessons were, for me, were really fascinating nonetheless, because, well, this course was about the Weimar Republic, the German right in general, Stalin, the folkish culture, and it was a sort of first immersion for me into mass society, press agencies, newspapers, lobbies, trade unions, parties, mass parties, small parties, institutions. I found it really fascinating because before I had a very conventional idea of mass society, so I was really involved into the complexity of mass dynamics. This was revealing, and so I continued to follow the Felicia's courses. I perceived how new they were in their image of fascism, because I too came out from a tradition in which, well, fascism was not a problem. This fascism was negative. All fascist values were something we had to refuse completely, but that was all. It was not interesting. For the first time, I found fascism a real interesting subject, something was an issue, a problem, even for today. And this was the reason why I began to follow every year the Felicia's courses, and then I decided to ask him to be my supervisor for my dissertation.
So this would have been in the early 70s?
In the early 70s. This is, I enrolled to the law school in fall 1969, then passed in the spring 1970 to the humanities school, and I attended the Felicius course, I think the following year, that is between the fall and the spring 1970-1971.
So already by then he was challenging the received opinion.
He was already challenging, even though the Felicius affair, that is the scandal, will rise some years after. Even after my graduation, that is, I graduated in December 1974,
mm-hmm.
and all the Felice affair was born in 1975 with the interview on fascism and the publication of his volume about the Mussolini Il Duce, that is, Mussolini, the consent to fascism,
mm-hmm.
that happened in 1975.
So you were right there during those years.
Yes,
was,
yes,
mm.
yes.
So what was he like as a advisor? It seems to me that he was a fairly austere person, perhaps, and a bit distant.
No,
or,
he was not austere, absolutely.
No.
He was...
Did he engage with you in your work, or was it more a distance relation?
He was continually suggesting new perspectives,
oh, really? Oh.
Documents, and interpretations. But he never, or almost never, intervened in my texts. That is, he read them, and his reaction was, well, they are very good. I would suggest you to go deeper in those documents, read this new essay, something like this.
Yeah, it's a very encouraging way of
teaching.
He
was very encouraging and very liberal in his approach. He never tried to suggest me any interpretation. Any.
That's great. And somewhat unusual in the Italian academic.
I think so.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. So what then did you write your dissertation on? What did you end up writing on?
I began in 1972 and 73 with researchers, and I wrote that in 1974. It came from my formation, because it was about, we may call it, the cultural origins of Christian democracy. The title of my thesis was The Political Culture of Catholic Action During Fascism.
It's important
topic. And this, I tried, it was not Mossian, as it is, I had met Moser as an early modern historian, but at the moment, I think I had not read much more about him. I met him in another seminar. I attended also in the political sciences school a course of history of the relation between church and state, held by Pietro Scoppola, who was a family friend, but also a very good historian. I attended his course, and during the course he asked us if we want to prepare a paper about some readings, and I chose the interpretations of fascism. I read the Felicius book about interpretations of fascism, and I remember I was impressed by the, not many, but two or three pages the Felicius devoted to Moses, the German ideology,
mm-hmm.
and also a couple of essays about the interpretation of fascism. But this was all. This, I had no more specific knowledge about Moses' work. This happened after. So my dissertation thesis depended much more on De Felice, his approach to the culture of fascism.
Well, before we talk more about your work and your research interests, perhaps we should briefly discuss your uncle Aldo Moro.
Yes.
In your New York address, you paid tribute to him, but I was surprised. I didn't realize that he... so unique in that he wasn't a typical Italian politician by any means. He was an intellectual, deeply religious, but religious in the way that you mentioned your family was religious.
Yes,
that it
exactly.
was a way of being, that it wasn't to be imposed on the political situation in a harsh way. It wasn't a necessarily political program that needed to be imposed on the culture at large, but that there was an ethical duty to engage in politics, that you couldn't stand back from politics. That he was essentially optimistic, and that he he was interested in governing. I mean, how to make systems work, how to figure out how to make representative, which seems to me to be so different from what we have now, where these parties really aren't interested in government, governing. They're interested really in power, and that seems to be. And perhaps that was always there in Italian politics or politics in general. But but I was always thinking of what, in reading a little bit about your uncle, that it seems to me that that Machiavellian, the core Machiavellian idea of how does a good man live in an evil world is very applicable to your uncle. So perhaps if you'd like to talk a little bit about him and about your relationship with him and your
absolutely
some of the
of course he was so a busy politician that
the family
perceived in some way that politics had taken him away from us. There was a common feeling of sort of that he lacked the family because he was so important as a politician. We saw him seldom. It is, of course, at Christmas, at Easter, and not much more.
Did he have a family of his own? A wife?
Yes, of course, a wife and four children.
Oh, four children.
And of course, when we met at Easter or at Christmas, his brothers and sister monopolized them. So we boys, not that we were not admitted, but I played with my cousins and stood with them. He was, I remember him as a very gentle man, and not absolutely similar to the stereotype the Italian media have built about him, that is a very pessimistic, sad, stern personality. It was absolutely not so. Probably was realist. This did not ignore all the difficulties he had ahead. But at the same time, he was ironic, ready to smile and to jokes. My father bought a house in Terracina, that is a sea, small town near Rome, south of Rome, to spend summer holidays there, below the apartment of my uncle. So we spent summer always together. Even during the summer, it was busy. I have some memories about him. There's one of the more, well, I think, what the things that hit me was that he spent many, many mornings and evenings in a small balcony out of the apartment in front of the sea with newspapers up to his knees, reading them one after the other, hours and hours.
Looking for specific things,
Looking for specific
trends.
Things. I think trends. It was his way of, one, of course, of his ways of keeping himself in touch with the country, with collective mentalities. He was not looking for political plots. I think he was looking simply for what the country was. And another thing I remember were his very long walking. He walked, his way of thinking was walking, and he walked very swiftly, often with my father. They went up and down for kilometers talking. And a third memory is when I was working on the political culture of Christian democracy, so I asked him, well, may I have an interview with you? It was very difficult. Many times it was delayed. In the end, I went to his home, and I appreciated how good a politician he was, because we talked for a couple of hours of everything, from music to records,
but not
about the...
He probably didn't necessarily want to talk about that.
Probably.
Yes. Well, he did have, it seems to have had a vision of Italy that was a country of diversity, of tolerance, you know, some idea of how that could develop in the Italian situation, that he had a very progressive vision.
Yes, yes. He was the children of a generation formed during fascism, and they had a very different approach to post-war democracy from the approach of the old leaders of the Catholic movement, like Sturzo, for example. This generation passed through fascism. Some of them were fascists. Some of them were critical of fascism, but inside the new society fascism had brought. Some of them were anti-fascists, but all the new generation was convinced that fascism was a wrong, obviously wrong, answer to essential issues, that is, how to have mass participation into politics. The previous generation, Sturzo's generation, was formed by liberals in the traditional meaning of the word. That is, they thought that, well, fortunately, fascism has ended. Now we go back to the pre-fascist liberal democracy, representative democracy, without any intervention of the state, without any problem of participation of the masses. The young generation had a very different approach. They had very confused ideas, I think, in general. But there was one thing they had very clear, that is, we cannot go back to the elitist liberal state as before. We need masses participation and the intervention of the state capable of promoting equality and participation. So this was a different and progressive, in a sense, Catholicism. And this may explain the militancy of my uncle into the leftist group of Christian Democracy at the beginning, the Dossettiani, and then his policy of opening to the socialists in the 1950s and 1960s.
And then shortly before he died, his role in that...
The communist affair is much more complicated. It is. I am convinced, not for my memory, but remembrance, but because of the studies that has been made on him in the last decades, that, well, he would have preferred always keeping the center-left policy. He was not a pro-communist, absolutely. But now the conditions had made impossible a center-left policy, because there was the Socialist Party who refused any government without the communists. And an electoral situation, that is the situation of the chambers in Italy after the elections of 1976, in which there were only two major parties, Christian Democracy and the Communists, they shared almost 80% of votes. So it was impossible any other majority. So an exceptional national solidarity was required, but as a temporary solution, with only a more long period goal, that was a sort of possible future legitimation of the communists as not anymore a revolutionary party, anti-democratic and linked to Moscow, but as a sort of social democracy fit to Italy.
Well, I'm sure he perceived that the Italian Communist Party had changed.
Yes.
Yeah. But, well, unless you have anything more to say about your uncle, I think we can...
I think not.
Okay. We can talk then a little bit more about your own work and
Mosse.
What you've written a little bit, perhaps, and then we'll go into Mosse. So, essentially, your research interests are in religion, politics.
Yes. At the beginning, I was interested in the relation between religion and politics in a very traditional way, that is, culture of ideas, political cultures. And this was the main subject of my first years, that is, the book I wrote about the formation of the Catholic ruling elite in Italy. Then I met Mosse, and I changed a little bit my perspectives. I think it's not necessary to explain why Mosse was so relevant in changing my perspective from the history of ideas to popular culture. But in this way, I saw something that I was not able to see before. That was that religion and politics were not linked only at a cultural level, but that modern mass politics influenced religion and transformed religion. I was studying fascism and Catholicism. At the beginning, I was trying to understand how much Catholics were independent or not from the fascist vision of the world, how much they consented or not to fascism, and something like this. But slowly, I realized that the real issue was how Catholicism was transformed by the impact of fascism. Because totalitarianism imposed to Catholicism to change. That is, the competition inside the totalitarian society was so high that Catholicism had to rebuild itself, presenting itself as an alternative totalitarianism. It is organization, militancy, propaganda, numbers, mobilization. All of those things were so relevant that I began to work on a more wide subject. It is the politicization of religion. It is, of course, religion has always been politicized a little bit. But I individuated a more precise transformation during the late 19th and the 20th century in which religion became a real mass ideology as the other mass ideologies, competing with them in all the possible fields. A philosophy, this is a Weltanschauung, Thomism, a social doctrine, mass organizations, parties. This is the subject about which I work so much. For example, I worked also about Catholic anti-Semitism. And this, in here I found exactly the same thing. There's traditional Catholic religious anti-Judaism was religious. That is, we do not like the Jews because they are following a wrong and obscure religion, and they do not recognize the truth. During the late 19th century and the 20th century, Catholic anti-Semitism was not anymore based on religion. It was based on the fact that the Jews were a minority, a powerful minority, with its values, without nation, with the domination on wealth and richness, secular arguments.
Which were influenced by political developments.
Exactly. That is, mass politics politicized and secularized even the Christian, the Catholic discourse on the Jews.
I could see where Mossi's work would really resonate with what you were.
Exactly. So yeah. Mossi was fundamental for my, that is, De Felice was fundamental for me in the methodology, for the methodology I apply to history. That is, the way of working on documents. But Mosse gave me a broader perspective in which to work.
So that continuity in Mosse's work between his work in
early modern
and how that carried through all of his work, his main themes were really, well, the fate of liberalism, of course, but
yes,
mass politics, how mass politics works, how you can make it work. Can you describe some of the overarching questions that he engaged with and how it influenced you, and also the Italian scene, the
yes.
Italian scholarly scene?
Yes.
His impact here.
I have always perceived that the main Moses question was about irrationality.
Yes.
I have told this also in my speech. This was my perception. Of course, the Holocaust, the problem of the issue of the Jews, but of course, as the revelation of something that came through centuries since early modernity, that was the. I remember the first book by Moss I read, it is Europe on the 16th century. Well, modernity begins, humanism, ration, science, but at the same time, how may we explain that our irrationality remains so powerful in the 16th century?
So that how did reason or rationality come to be somewhat accepted by the church, by religion, but how, and that there even was a possibility of rationality.
Yes.
Even this is optimistic to some extent. But how those other forces always bubble below, and that this was always a fragile.
Yes.
Fragile structure.
Exactly. I remember that in my Camerino speech honoring Mosse, I called him the historian of modern irrationality. Since then, this was my main idea, that is the ring that united all these works was in a attempt of explaining and understand in rational terms the power of irrationality in modernity. And I think very negative the fact that in Italy, for example, almost everything Mosse wrote has been translated as for the late modern studies, but nothing has been translated, almost nothing, of the early modern.
Really?
Yes, neither the struggle for sovereignty nor the holy pretense has never been translated. And I
should do that.
So in Italy, Mosse is known as a historian of nazism and nationalism, and not as an historian of early modernity, as it was, really.
Mm-hmm. There was it's important to know about that part of his work.
Absolutely. For me, it was absolutely indispensable. That was, I told you, my first reading was the early modern Mosse, because the book about Europe summed up many of his discoveries. So when I came to the nationalization of the masses on all the other Moses works, in my perception it was clear the path Mosse was following, but in Italy it was not so.
Yes, that does limit the understanding of him if you don't
yes.
have access to English and see the overall
yes.
trajectory.
Yes, yes.
Trajectory of his
yes,
work.
I think so.
So, well, perhaps we could talk just a little bit about your own personal encounters with
Mosse.
Yes,
I already told that I read him in 1970, his book. Then I met in the seminar, the Scopolas seminar. My real discovery happened with the publication of The Nationalization of the Masses. De Felice told us of the importance of this book and urged us to read it. And you remember his preface was comparing Mosse with Zynga or Mark Bloch, so very high standard. When I read the book, I shared completely this vision. I was really fascinated. I was one of the students who were working with De Felice. There were other people around me. There was Emilio Gentile, there was Luigi Goglia, there was Mario Toscano, there was Niccolò Zapponi, who died very early. But he was probably the person who wrote, I think, one of the best analyses of Mosse's perspective on the nationalization of the masses in a short essay in Storia Contemporanea. So we began to discuss about Mosse.
Mm-hmm.
We began to read extensively his works, and we understood quite well the novelty of his well, the novelty of the methodology was applied to history. I remember we promoted a seminar about the culture of Western Europe when it was translated in Italy. And together, everybody, each one had to prepare something about his, well, for example, I worked extensively on the way in which Christianity was analyzed in Mosse's book.
Yeah.
But Mosse became absolutely central for us, for the work of the group around De Felice and Storia Contemporanea. And then we met him, because at the beginning of the 1980s, De Felice invited him to take a seminar at La Sapienza, the School of Political Sciences, and he came. Around the table, we were 20 people. He talked about his new researches on First World War and racism. And racism and First World War. And so we knew him by person. It was interesting too, because he was not absolutely the standard scholar we expected. This he dressed in a very unconventional way. He had no attitude of being a personality or a luminaire. Absolutely.
He wasn't pretentious the way.
Absolutely, absolutely. His aspect was not so fascinating. He had those big and thick glasses. But he began to speak. I realized immediately that he was a great orator. He fascinated us with mobility of his eyes. And another feature I remember so well, it was he addressed to us without any form of hierarchy. We were accustomed in Italy that high standard academics, they seem to make you a great concession speaking with you. This was not absolutely the case. He was curious. He was interested in everything you may say. He had a very strong love for discussion, different perspective. It was very, very, very interesting and very fascinating. And then, from then on, Mosse became one of the fundamentals of my work as an historian. Then I became in 1990, full professor. I had my courses, and I began to teach very much depending on Moss's research. My first course was about the history of anti-Semitism in the contemporary world. And I began to, another of my first courses was about religions of politics. So I began to use his books to have them as required readings for students. And you have seen the group of students who formed with me, they, as I am, they are in love with Moshe. For them too, his work has been fundamental.
Then you went to Camerino. And
my first university was Camerino, a very small university with few students enrolling courses. I remember when I took Mosse to Camerino, we made the car journey together. I don't remember. You were in Camerino.
So that was for the Lario?
For the Laurea.
Yes, I was there.
You were in car together with us?
Yes.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember.
It was a wonderful trip.
And I remember that Mosse was completely astonished when we work in Camerino. But do you live in Camerino? I said, no, I don't live in Rome. Where do you go there? Well, not every week. 3 days every 15 days. It was completely a shared edition. But the students, they must live there. No, they do not live there. They come every day, which is his class, and go away. And he commented that it was completely contrary to everything he was thinking about the university as a community of professors and students.
Very different vision of...
Yes, well, of course Camerino was a sort of extreme case,
mm-hmm.
but even in a big university, large university as it is Roma, a community of professors and students, as it happened in the American campuses,
it's
not so easy.
It's changing because of technology. Because of
Moodle.
Yes, and so many other distractions. But essentially, students, the undergrads, still live
together
on campus. A lot of them do, and so you do get that sense of community. But it's much different than when George taught or when I went to school, certainly. But I remember that as an extraordinary event in Camerino, and the dinner.
Yes, it was.
Spini was there, and so many of your colleagues that were students from students of De Felice.
Yes,
that dinner in the castle of. Of Cesare Borgia and the performances, those incredible, and the Alpini, the choir.
Yes, the choir about the songs of the First World War.
Yes,
the Alpine
really,
troops.
And the dance, dance concert, and it was really a very well appreciated event. Yes. So.
Yes.
But. Well, maybe now I guess we could. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. You've already gone.
No, I have a time.
Okay.
If you want, I have time.
Okay. Well, unless you want to talk more about Moss's impact here in Italy.
Yes.
We could talk a bit about the interview.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this group of students that you have engaged in Moss's work, but also in um, well, reviving interest in Aldo Moro in Christian democracy, in that part of Italian history. But the interview came out in 81, I think, and this was done, I think, 3 years, or it came out.
I think it was 70, made in 1979.
79, that's right, the beginning, yeah, okay, and came out. So, I think the interview really illuminates,
yes,
what your uncle was up to,
yes,
in many ways, and also how appropriate George's ideas about mass politics are for the Italian political situation, and how sophisticated and understanding your uncle had of the issues,
yes,
involved. The first edition wasn't received that well.
No.
And there are probably lots,
no,
of reasons for,
no,
that.
No. Yeah. Well, that is really surprising. If you read the interview now, and you read many of the things written about Moro in 1979, 1980, 1991, Moses' interview is still a very clear, interesting, and valid text. While much of the literature written about Moro has not stood the test of time so well, clearly. They seem, many of those writing, not Moses, but those writing, seems to come from prehistory now. Nonetheless, at the time, this vision of Mosse was not well received. The causes, I think the reasons were many. One of the merit of Mosse was the deprovincialization of Moro's case, that is to put the Moro's case inside the framework of the issue of parliamentary and mass politics today in general in the West. At the time in Italy, the majority of people was convinced, wrongly convinced, that Italy was an absolutely peculiar, different case that stood no comparison with anything else. Second prejudice was that an American scholar could not understand everything about the Italian situation. This was the immediate consequence of the first point. That is, if Italy is different, no foreigner may understand us. We are too much complicated, we are too much different from the rest of the world. A third possible reason of not understanding Mosse was a linguistic problem. That is, of course, Mosse used the adjective liberal discussing about Moro's policy. And this was correctly translated in Italian as liberale. But liberale in Italian has a very different meaning from the Anglo-Saxon, American, and British liberal. This is something I have to explain every time I met not Italian students, not continental European students, because for Germans and French is probably the same,
mm-hmm,
that it, for Italians. That is, that liberalism in the Anglo-American sense means not only the choice of the individual as the first absolute value, and so liberty of thinking, press, association, and so on, but also commitment to equality and possibly reforms, and in some cases even intervention of the state in a democratic sense. So
Very much so in the American.
Yes, especially in America. Yes, mm-hmm. It means progressive.
Mm-hmm.
So Italian readers perceived the definition of Moro as a liberal politician, as though it meant a conservative, moderate liberal. It was not the case for Masse. So there was a sort of reaction against this wrong idea of an author who was defining Moro more conservative than he was. And the last, and I think not least, element of negative reaction was Moses' discourse about myths, symbols, and politics. The importance of not rational, not doctrinal, not theoretical discourse, but of symbols and myths. This was new for many of the readers, and this was considered unacceptable. Italy was divided at the time, I think, in two dominating cultures, Marxism, for which superstructures had no particular interest, and political sociology, for which the symbolic dimension of politics was not considered relevant. I read Murray Edelman's book.
Oh, yes?
Yes, because I found him cited in the notes of Masse.
Mm-hmm.
Never translated it into Italian.
Hmm.
The Italian political sociology was absolutely not interested in this symbolic dimension.
In this country, that's extraordinary, given its history.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, but it was so. So, Moses' discourse seemed extravagant. Again, a foreigner with very extravagant views about Italy. This was his negative reaction. Now the situation is completely changed. Now,
with the new edition.
Now Mosse is quoted by almost everybody who's working on Moros now. That's very incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And even the path of researchers, that is, at the time, this is when first the interview was published, there were very few scholar research on Moro, but the few researchers were Italian, that is almost totally devoted to the Italian framework. Now Moro is studied in a comparative international perspective, that is the same impulse of Moses' interview has received now quite acceptance.
I think it's quite extraordinary how prescient and relevant Mosse's work is in the current political context.
Yes.
That his work has held up so much better than many of his contemporaries.
Yes, I agree completely.
It's extraordinary.
Yes, if you read again just the interview on Moro, there is an analysis of the perils of modern democracies on the fact that, of course, the problem of fascism is probably ended as such, but the issues and causes that provoked fascism are still there.
And the techniques.
The techniques, the problem of fitting masses with life to make sense, to have a politic in which there is a feeling and sense to life, irrationality, anxieties, doubts, needs. This is always with us. And I think that few readings as this may be an introduction to more recent politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that whole idea that in a sense, in fascism, the alignment of the individual and the state and this the level of satisfaction that can give, or perceived security or a sense of a whole, is something that is lacking and very much needed or required by the current generations. You know, sometimes I think it's to some extent just boredom, but others it's just a kind of cultural satisfaction, you know, because we have such a mercantile economy now, and advertising and everything is about satisfaction. Even literature is about pushing buttons,
yes.
You know. And this, I think, carries over to politics. I think it's in you know, we see that dimension, you know.
Yes.
Where you find that. So.
Yes.
But that's rather.
Probably politics is even more spectacular than it was at the Nazi and fascist or communist age.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this, the main reasons of Moss's research are even more evident now than before. And another element is really clear is that we are now in an age of game, an age of economic crisis, disemployment, acceleration of progress, that is the digital dimension, the internet, immigration, that is
mass immigration.
Yeah. So the problem of the well-furnished house is still there, absolutely.
And then also those questions of environmental degradation, which is partially to blame for the 65 million migrants that are on the road, but the complexity of the problems of rapid population growth.
Yes.
And well, the disconnect of the technology elite from the concerns of the masses.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, they have a belief in technology that is positivistic.
Absolutely.
Everything is, you know, solvable by this.
Yes.
Creation of a new gadget or a new
yes.
AI without much thought about the consequences.
Yes.
Or responsibility for them. It's really,
absolutely.
It's extraordinary. But
yes.
We shouldn't go off too far.
Another great result of Moss's research was, I think, of the researchers about racism, how irrational science may be, too. And not to have too much confidence in science itself when science comes out from its limits.
Mm-hmm.
And today we are living another age of irrational devotion to some aspects of science.
Mm-hmm.
There is another thing I would like to point, reflecting about Italian case, I think that we have an extraordinary contradiction, paradoxical situation. The Italian political system was one of the most stable systems in the world, contrary to what many may think, because since 1945, up to 1992, one party was central and had the government. That is Christian Democracy. It was formed during the Cold War. It was a blocked political system. Very dangerous, because numbers were never, well, they made never possible a very strong democratic majority, but it was very stable.
It worked.
It worked, very stable. This system was blocked, but was based on a sort of mutual consensus. That is, well, the communists were out of power. They were at the opposition, but the Gasperi especially, but all the Christian democratic leaders after, they kept a sort of democratic relation with the communists. It was mutual. The communists did not pass, did never pass to revolutionary action as they would have made, if they liked. Christian Democrats never thought to put communism out of law. So there was a sort of mutual consensus. Paradoxically, when the Cold War ended and Italy would have had the possibility to enter into a normality status of common legitimization of political forces, a normal alternative to government, well, I think we have never seen a situation of more strong delegitimization of political forces as it happened at the age of Berlusconism and anti-Berlusconism. And today, we have political forces at Northern League, the Five Stars Movement, that are very ideological. When you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation the fact that Moro was a man interested in governing more than in ideologies, now we seem to have entered a new age of mass idealization and mutual delegitimization of political forces.
And it seems no consequences for not being able to govern. It's almost as if that doesn't matter. You know, the rational.
We will see what will happen, but of course there is also a push of facts that is, they will have to find some solution in the end.
Well, let's see.
But the starting point is absolutely not, let's find a solution. The starting point is, I have my truth and I will not compromise it with everybody.
Then compromise is almost a dirty word.
Yes, in Italy it has become a dirty word. This is something very interesting because, for example, my uncle Aldo Moro was a man of compromises, but not in the low and negative meaning of the word. If you think to compromise, come to, from Latin, cum promittere, that is to promise together something. I think it is not a mean practice, it's a high practice. It's what politics is about, to find the best possible common solutions. Mm-hmm. Now we invented, in Italy, we invented the word inciucio, that is, means very almost criminal
stubbornness and
accord. And political forces consider every compromise negative. That is, I don't see why. It's another feature of the ideologization of politics.
Well, you see it in the US too. I think Trump is the same. And of course he's attempting, or that movement is attempting, to align with European movements So it's a worldwide phenomenon, it seems to me, a new age.
Yes.
That may rapidly burn out, we can only hope. But, well, perhaps we'll talk a little bit about your current work.
Yes.
With the Academia.
Yes.
Moro and your students and some of the collaborations with the MASA program.
Okay.
And so I understand you're conducting research on Aldemoro.
Yes.
And a number of the students that have come through the MASI program have been working on aspects of this.
Yes.
And I hope in the future we can continue that in this collaboration with you and Roma Tre. So what are you working on?
At the moment, I am working on the juvenile years of my uncle. I have already published many years ago, so in 1983, a long essay about his cultural formation. But my perspective now is completely different. I was very much impressed by the books of John Tedeschi.
Oh yes,
yes.
The memoir of John Tedeschi, which brings in Italian Jewish history,
exactly,
with his family history.
Yes, and by another book I have read, it is many years ago, it is Mikhail Ignatieff, Russian Album. They proved to me that you may be a member of a family and an historian and write a good history book on your family. And second, they suggested to me a family perspective, that is, not anymore a research devoted only to Aldemoro as an intellectual, but as an intellectual inside a familiar and social milieu. It is a more brighter and a little more motion perspective, I think. So I have intensively worked on the papers of my family, the private papers, private life. I am convinced that what a politician is not only culture, ideas, project. It's also what private life builds, that is, feelings, needs. Even not conscious values. So I'm working on this. And working to this, I discovered a very extraordinary case in my family. That is the history of my grandmother, who was a southern elementary teacher in Cosenza, Calabria, but was also a feminist, a journalist, a speaker in meetings. So I have gave to Bompiani, the editor, the publisher Bompiani, a book about her. Then I'm working to the book about my uncle. And the third engagement I have is also related to tomorrow. I am president of the national edition of his works. A great enterprise funded by the Italian Ministry of Cultural Affairs that will publish, not in paper, but in digital format, all his writings, journalistic, religious, political, law writings.
And so some of the students are working on that?
Some of my students are working on a new biography of Aldemoro, Donatello, Laura and Nanni. They are working to three parts. They divided the periods of Moro's life into three parts. A political biography, but a biography inspired by this international comparative perspective that is to locate Monod's case as a case of a leader of Western democracy into mass politics.
That comes out of this interview to some extent in some of the insights. Well, thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
It's
always a real pleasure to think about a man who has changed my life so much.
Thank you so much. And perhaps we'll continue in Madison.
Oh.